there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on Vermont Edition. And I wanted to let you know that what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Short and sweet, right to the good stuff. Thank you.
Many, many Vermonters know the name Ethan Allen very well. He became famous for capturing Fort Ticonderoga during the Revolutionary War, as well as for failing to take Montreal from the British. He's considered a founding father of Vermont. Fewer people, perhaps, know of Lucy Terry Prince, who lived in Vermont during the same era as Ethan Allen, in the 1700s. She was enslaved as a very young child in Massachusetts, but eventually became free and settled with her family in Guilford, Vermont. A new historical film tells a fictionalized story about Ethan Allen and Lucy Prince based on their remarkable lives. It's a film by Jay Craven. He's a filmmaker with more than 10 feature films to his name, among many, many other projects. He is the founder of Kingdom County Productions alongside his wife and fellow filmmaker Bess O'Brien. Jay also founded and directed St. Johnsbury's Catamount Arts and co-founded Circus Smirkus. We are very lucky to have him in the studio with us today. Jay, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Yeah, thanks, Michaela.
We're very glad to have you. And listeners, you can join the conversation as well. Have you seen other films by Kingdom County Productions? Or maybe you're a Vermonter who worked on one of these films. Call in and tell us about it. Our number is 800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So, Jay, before we get into the fascinating backstory of the production of this film and where the idea came from, tell us a little bit about the plot and these two main characters of yours.
Well, we have two characters that we track. I mean, I've taught film in various forms in college for 25 years, and the first thing I tell students is you always have to have one protagonist. So here we are with two protagonists in this film, and they are Ethan Allen, as you say, who I think is well known to us, especially for his mythic status, and Lucy Terry Prince, whose poem Bar's Fight about the 1746 Deerfield Massacre is the first known work of African-American literature. Mm. And just so happens, she spent most of her life in Vermont. Mm. And moved to Guilford in the mid-1770s to create a homestead with her husband and children. And during that time, you know, settled into the fabric and also faced complications, opposition, resistance to their presence there. Their closest neighbor really sort of coveted their land. And so that story also unfolds. And one thing that became known to me during the research for the film is that Guilford was also a hotbed of pro-New York sentiment. Of course, Vermont was contested territory, with both New York and New Hampshire claiming various land titles throughout the region. And west of the Green Mountains, in Bennington and the areas that we sort of associate with early Vermont history, it was settlers holding New Hampshire grants. Ethan Allen was one of the political leaders there who resisted New York. But east of the Green Mountains, especially in southeastern Vermont, it was a Yorker stronghold, although the princes were holding a New Hampshire grant. Mm. So that complicated their existence even further, but frankly placed them on a footing whereby combining the stories makes a certain amount of sense, both thematically and even historically and even geographically. Because Ethan Allen, in fact, invaded Guilford twice with like 250 men, went house to house arresting Yorkers that were considered disloyal to Vermont. Hmm. And in fact, one of those invasions initiated at Packer's Corner Tavern, which was about a quarter mile from where Lucy and Abijah, her husband and her children, lived. So anyway, in the process of developing a narrative that really digs into this period, a lot of parallels came into play, along with sort of a thematic connection in terms of land and freedom. Mm.
Well, let's play a clip from the film here. We have one featuring the actor playing John Noyes, who you mentioned. He lived in this grand house right across the road from Lucy Terry Prince and her husband and children. He really hated them. And in this scene, he tells Lucy Prince's husband that he needs to pay taxes.
I see you brought your family from Massachusetts.
I built this place. That was the tough part. I need help. My sons, Caesar, Festus. Boys, meet Mr. John Noyes. Lives in a handsome home just a stone's throw down the road.
Violet, doesn't have your southern light. I come with a neighborly reminder, Prince. Taxes are due to the province of New York.
Sorry for any misunderstanding, Mr. Noyes. My land titles were issued under the New Hampshire grants. Thought you knew that. I don't own land in New York or owe any taxes.
The problem is, most folks around here are loyal to New York. We keep the town afloat. School, sheriff, people vote, say what they want.
A neighborly reminder, but he did not act very neighborly at all. He really harassed the Prince family, right?
Yes. I mean, John Noyes was also politically connected in the town, which we did a very close reading of sort of Guilford Town history from that period. And it's a terrific account of different families, different political forces. And because there was so much turmoil, it enters into this discussion. And yes, John Noyes appeared to us, you know, to be an ambitious Yorker town official who, after all of this upheaval, in fact, served 13 years in the Vermont legislature, was also a presidential elector in the national election of 1800, which was a contested election between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. So he was a figure really working to advance his career also.
Well, listeners, if you are listening to the show from the Guilford area and have learned some of this history that we're discussing with filmmaker Jay Craven today, give us a call. Tell us what you know about Lucy Prince and the history of your area. 800-639-2211. So tell us, Jay, about how in this film you weave together these two stories of a formerly enslaved woman and of this Revolutionary War hero.
Well, we saw, first of all, some parallels, both of them caught up in what I would really have to describe as the turbulence of this moment. It was a chaotic time. There was a lot of conflict. I mean, Ethan Allen and his people were fighting off Yorker encroachments, sheriffs coming in with posses to seize land. They were pushing back. Likewise, they were punishing people who settled with New York titles. There were whippings. There were houses being burned to the ground. There were kidnappings. A guy was strung up to the on the signpost at the Catamount Tavern in Bennington. So what Ethan Allen was experiencing was this turbulence on mostly the west side of the mountains. But of course, Ethan also had national aspirations to play a role in the American Revolution. I've talked to historian Nat Philbrick, who said that he believes that Ethan experienced what was not uncommon among sort of military and political leaders of that time, the great man, you know, impulse, the desire to really project oneself onto a larger stage.
That hasn't gone away in the interim.
That's the question. Yes, and we'll, I'm sure, have those conversations at the screenings. But and so also the Allens, Ira and Ethan Allen, and their cousin, remember, Baker, formed a land company, and they acquired some 200,000 acres of land. So the notion of land and liberty very much was part of the Ethan Allen trajectory. And for the princes, it was a 100-acre plot that was sort of gifted to Abijah after he was freed from enslavement. And their goal was also land and freedom on a much smaller scale. So we saw those parallel themes. And so what did they have to do to advance their cause compared to what Ethan Allen was doing to advance his cause? And we see also a brief intersection where during one of Ethan Allen's incursions into Guilford, they have an encounter. We know for a fact that Lucy, in her continuing pursuit of justice for harassment that she experienced, made it all the way to the governor's council meeting in Norwich, presided over by Governor Thomas Chittenden with Ira Allen in attendance. So there's another overlap between the Allen forces and Lucy's quest for justice. So in that one encounter, Lucy and Ethan find themselves on the same side, actually, because she is also resisting this Yorker encroachment, which also is individualized through the personality of John Noyes.
It seems through making this film, you've become an expert in early American history, Jay.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We just donated the books that we assembled to do the research, because I also developed the script through 15 weeks of work with 15 Sarah Lawrence students during the spring of 2020. And we used 162 sources for the research that we conducted during that time, and just donated all of that material to St. Johnsbury Academy's library during the spring, because it was just taking up too much room.
Spring 2020, a fateful spring.
Yeah, for sure. Half of it conducted online because of COVID.
Well, if you have a question for filmmaker Jay Craven, you can email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org or call 800-639-2211. We got an email from a listener named Cliff who asks, does the Ethan Allen film mention Benedict Arnold's joint victory with Allen at Fort Ticonderoga?
We originally scripted a scene to represent the seizure of Fort Ticonderoga that budget and schedule prohibited us from actually filming. Although we reference the Battle of Fort Ticonderoga in the opening to the film and use some artwork from the period to describe it. And part of our feeling was that people know that story. So we don't really get into Benedict Arnold, although we do get into the question of Ethan's flirtation with Britain in terms of their desire to annex Vermont as part of their North American, you know, territory. Mm. We also had to make a choice at some level. We do depict elements of the Battle of Bennington. We also show the skirmish over the question of Ethan Allen's incursion into Montreal, where he is seized by redcoats and placed on a prison ship. So those elements of sort of action are depicted in the film. We reference Ticonderoga, in fact, even end the film with Ethan reciting part of his own account of the seizure of Ticonderoga. We don't really get into Benedict Arnold. We frankly realized very early in this project that it could be a series very easily. And, you know, if we'd had the resources and the time, that would have been the thing to do. We had to make some hard decisions. We hoped to do the Ticonderoga segment. We just got to a point where we knew it was going to take 2 or 3 days. We'd probably have to go to Ticonderoga to get the realistic, background for it, and it was just more than we could handle.
Oh, cross the lake? No.
Yeah, right. There you go.
We have a call from a listener named Dave in Hinesburg. Dave, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing today? I'm calling to put a plug in for the Ethan Allen Homestead in Burlington, down on the Intervale. A lot of the history you've been sharing, I'm actually a school teacher, so I'll back up. We've visited the homestead quite a few times over the years, and a lot of the history you're sharing today, kids have learned about by going to the homestead. They even have a replica of the tavern that you mentioned over at the Ethan Allen Homestead. So I'd like to kind of put in a plug for teachers and people who want to learn more about it, kind of firsthand walking on the Ethan Allen Homestead, to check it out.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Dave. Did you visit there, Jay, when you were researching this film?
We did not visit there. We, in terms of how far we take the story, it's just before Ethan moves to the homestead.
Ah.
But we do show the events that led to it, including his encounter with Francis Brush Buchanan, who became Fanny Allen, who was quite an interesting character in and of herself. I mean, she actually was the stepdaughter of Ethan's nemesis, Crean Brush.
Ooh, good name for a nemesis.
Yeah, so we dig into that story a little bit, even though there's speculation about how that relationship played out, and there's mystery and potential intrigue and maybe even murder involved with it.
Oh, you do have to make a series, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. So, but yes, I mean, Ethan came to a point in his career where he sort of let go of the land empire, let go of the political and military status, and retired to the homestead in northern Vermont, saying, just give me enough room for a cabin and to raise my family. And of course, with his new wife, Frances Brush Buchanan, they had 3 kids, and Ethan died at the age of 52 while he was living there.
Well, there seems to be a wealth of information about Ethan Allen. Of course, that's very different for the other main character in this movie, Lucy Terry Prince. She was taken from her home where she was born in West Africa, brought to the United States as a enslaved person. And there really isn't very much documentation about her life. How did you go about crafting this character?
Well, there has been sort of a mythic presence for those that are really, you know, dug in to find out about Lucy Terry Prince because of the poem Bars Fight. Although it's interesting, as a clear storyteller who used to have sort of soirees on the porch of the home where she was enslaved in Deerfield, she would invite people to come and tell their stories. And clearly she was prolific in her own storytelling. But Bars Fight is the only known poem that survives. And in fact, it wasn't even published for 100 years after it was written, but people knew it by heart. It was sort of the telling of that incident in Deerfield of the conflict between, indigenous fighters and local settlers and British elements as well. But, you know, it's Gretchen Gerzina, of course, has written a book called Mr. and Mrs. Prince, which really is about her own journey to discover more about this mysterious character. And she found fragments of information in various places that led her to believe, for example, that Lucy continued to write because she found a receipt from a store where paper was purchased, that she, you know, sewed because there was thread and fabric that was purchased. And there were also court records because of the conflicts that developed with John Noyes. So with this sort of skeletal framework of information around Lucy Terry Prince, we then build from that, borrowing from other elements of history from that time, the church in local communities at that time, the history of slavery in northern New England, a so-called runaway slave who given refuge in Brattleboro. You know, so we looked into local history, we looked into New England history, because the story of enslavement is also not terribly well developed in terms of a New England narrative. So that was part of what interested us. Not that we deal with Lucy for a long time in her condition of being enslaved. In fact, the film opens with her manumission being settled because her husband, who had fought in the French and Indian War, used the cash that he earned to buy her freedom.
Mm. Well, actually, let's play a clip from that first scene. This is right after Lucy's owner, Mrs. Abigail Wells, signs her release from slavery. And Lucy here asks that Abigail also release her children.
Perhaps I could have a word with Mrs. Wells in private. This is your day of freedom, and we all know that.
Not sure how I'd ever be free without my children. Abigail, I need to protect my children. Please, sign their releases so they could never be taken away from me.
It's a gut-wrenching exchange there. Could you tell us about how you cast the role of Lucy Terry Prince?
Well, it was just as we were starting to move out of COVID, and there were no live auditions possible. And traditionally, I've always gone to New York and had casting sessions or worked with a casting director to pitch actors that I knew about. So we were really left with online auditions. And Eva Ndachi was one of probably 30 women who auditioned for the part. And I just immediately took a liking to her, despite the fact that she had not had a lot of acting experience. She grew up in Kenya, wanted to, you know, get out into the larger world, did it through modeling. Went to Paris and became a fairly popular fashion model, and then went to New York and worked there, but always wanted to act, and finally went to Los Angeles and started auditioning and got some parts. She came to the audition and, to me, just had a freshness and a clarity and a directness and a charisma that just she was clearly the one for the part, and I really just fell for her right on the spot. And she's actually coming to Vermont for the screenings in Brattleboro and in Burlington next week. So I think she brought a lot to it, and I think also delivers some period authenticity, which is really helpful to taking the film where it needs to go.
Mm. Well, she's just remarkable in the role. Yeah. Kathy just wrote to us to say, I'll not forget this little gem from Kingdom County Productions. High Water is just 34 minutes long, but it conveys the world for one young farm boy and his 37 Plymouth in the Northeast Kingdom in 1959. It's got it all.
Thank you.
Now, Jay, in 2022, you spoke to my colleague Nina Keck while this movie, Lost Nation, was still in production. And you told her at the time that this was going to be your last film, but it is not. You've created another film, Major Barbara. First, before we get to Major Barbara, why'd you decide to keep going?
Well, I mean, to be very honest, this was a difficult production. Grueling, really. It was, again, post-COVID. Students were a little bit out of sorts. There were actually some conflicts that developed in and among crew. And I think part of it was just, again, this stress time. There were COVID tests a couple times a week. A couple people did get sick, had to be quarantined. Some students were struggling with the fact that they really hadn't even been on their own college campuses yet, but here they were away from campus for a whole semester. And just the physical demands of this production. This was a very ambitious production. It includes 52 different locations, 43 speaking parts, you know, battle scenes, all kinds of weather, cold nights, all night. And I wanted to come out of the experience knowing also what the future of the program could be, the program that we've developed over time, Semester Cinema, where 30 professionals mentor and collaborate with 45 students from a dozen colleges to make an ambitious feature film for national release. It's a huge undertaking, and I did not come out of that project feeling like it was quite the right time. And I also, frankly, wanted to go out, if possible, on a more positive note than this difficult production. So that was sort of the end of it. And normally we would start thinking immediately after we stop shooting, even before we've edited the film, on what the next project will be. And I found myself thinking about it. And I said, okay, I think we should go again. We did. We shot this last spring, winter and spring, based on George Bernard Shaw's comedy, Major Barbara. And I said comedy might be a good way to go in. And frankly, we also brought back a lot of the so-called family of Semester Cinema. Seven of our alumni came and worked on the production. You know, our cinematographer from Martin Eden came back in. My two sons got involved with the project. So, you know, I was betting as much as I could that we could really turn it around. And this last round was really fabulous in so many ways. So that was very satisfying. And I actually do feel that there's some young leadership that is poised to take the project forward. So I'm excited about that, where I will play a producing role but will not be directing and will not be the producer, senior producer.
It's an easing out.
There you go.
Our number is 800-639-2211 if you have questions or thoughts for filmmaker Jay Craven. We have Jill in Richmond on the line. Jill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, I was wondering why you titled it Lost Nation.
Well, that's a good question. First, I was actually thinking of calling it Land and Freedom, but the British director Ken Loach made a fabulous film called Land and Freedom that is sort of set during the Spanish Civil War. Then I thought for a little while of Land and Liberty, but it sounded a little bit too formal and academic. And I just sort of stumbled across Lost Nation a little bit. I called Jeffrey Lent, who, of course, has written a terrific novel, Vermont writer, called Lost Nation. And he said, well, everybody and their brother has claimed either to have lived in or to have written about Lost Nation, so you're welcome to it. I don't know. I mean, first of all, Vermont was an independent republic for 13 years before it became a state. So there was a long period of time, relatively long period of time, where it was a sort of outlier. And frankly, where they also were mired in some conflict with the Continental Congress and with the United States as known at that time. They didn't become a state until 1791, which was actually a couple of years after Ethan Allen died. And in fact, Alexander Hamilton, who had been a rival of Ethan Allen's of sorts and was quite critical of the Green Mountain Boys, ultimately was the person who helped to move Vermont to statehood, partly because he still feared they might connect with the British. So anyway, it's an outlier state. And so that seemed to suggest some element of sort of lost nation. Also, I think that the complications around really delivering on the promise of the American Revolution, I think is an ongoing struggle, frankly, and suggests some element of pause and to consider what is a whole nation, what is a complete nation, what is a connected nation. And so Lost Nation as a concept, I think is worth thinking about as we think about, you know, American history, the civics of the moment, whatever. I don't know. It's I agree that it's not a terribly poetic title, maybe, but it seemed to encapture some elements that I think will be good for conversation at screenings.
Mm. Well, thank you for the question, Jill. Jay, you brought up the screenings and the conversations that will be a part of them. Tell us about this film tour that you're kicking off.
Well, we're committing to play 50 Vermont towns with the film, so it's a 50-town tour. We open next week on Wednesday and Thursday at the Latches Theater in Brattleboro. We then come to Burlington for Friday and Saturday, the 12th and 13th. We then go to Montpelier the following week and to Middlebury on July 20th and to St. Johnsbury and Greensboro and Bennington and Arlington and Randolph and St. Albans. We will be touring the state probably for a year, to be very honest with you. We've already booked some fall dates in Bellows Falls and Essex and at Dartmouth College. And so as long as there are audiences that are interested in exploring some of this Vermont history and want to have some conversation, we will be on the road with it. Then after that, we will begin looking further into New England. We will certainly play the film extensively in New Hampshire because New Hampshire is connected to this history. We have a couple of dates this summer on Cape Cod because we filmed part of the movie on Nantucket, also in western Massachusetts, also in southern Vermont. We were based at Marlborough, the old Marlborough College campus, for 3 weeks. So we're going to be playing Nantucket, Woods Hole Film Festival, the Rhode Island Film Festival, a few dates outside of Vermont this summer. But we're focused really initially on really covering Vermont before we start taking it other places.
Mm-hmm. You sound busy.
Well, it's always, you know, it's at an era for an independent filmmaker when the fate of your hard work can often be just being dumped into streaming where you don't know who's watching the film or, you know, what response they have to
right.
it. The idea of live screenings, which has always been part of what we do, really continues to appeal to us. That's really what it's all about, is connecting with real audiences, having real conversations, and really allowing the film to come alive and figure out what the film is, because the audience is the last part of creation. The film is not complete until an audience really connects with it. And every screening is a little bit different because of the chemistry that sort of evolves during the screening between the film and the audience that's there. And I could talk about that for a while, but it's sort of part of the fun.
Well, what you're saying reminds me of this editorial you wrote for the Caledonian Record. And you wrote, I'm quoting here, "Most of my audience will probably be my age because we're the generation still attached to this idea of cinema experienced in the dark among friends and neighbors." Do you think the generations that have come after you that they don't appreciate that in the same way and that something's lost there?
I do believe that it's a challenge. I think that it's sort of the hyper-commercialization of media in general and of cinema in particular that has sort of led us to that point. However, I also think we don't have a lot of opportunities to see films that come out of our own history and culture. And so when you do, I find that audiences will respond. The question of younger audiences is a question. And of course, I also present performing arts in the Northeast Kingdom through the KCP Presents series. What we've done there is offer free tickets to students, and we will be offering free tickets to students for this show as well. And on terms of performing arts, our audience has grown from 9 students per show to 150 or more. And so that has also brought families and parents that are in their 30s and 40s to see music, theater, and dance, and we're thrilled about that. So we will put some effort into trying to reach younger audience here. Of course, the film included a lot of college students in the making of it, and we will go to each of their colleges. And when we do, we'll get good audiences of college students responding to the work, and that's also a satisfaction that I wouldn't necessarily have if I were just making the movie and putting it out into the world through streaming.
Sure. 800-639-2211 is our number if you have questions for Jay Craven or just are a fan of one of his films or films from Kingdom County Productions, from The Hungry Heart to Ask Us Who We Are to Where Is Stephanie. Jay, this is a bit of a brass tacks question for you about film screenings, but I've always wondered it. You said you're going to do 50 of these screenings. Are you going to watch the film yourself at every single one?
No. Although I will watch it unexpectedly. If there's a great crowd and the energy is terrific, I will watch the film with them. And I'll certainly be watching the first 10 or 15 screenings all the way through because I don't, you know, at this point, the film is being mastered today in California. You know, the film has just been finished. I was in the sound studio 2 weeks ago finishing the sound mix on the film. So I want to fully absorb this film. In the past, I also tend to make some tweaks after I've seen it a few times. I hope I don't do that, but I might.
It must be hard to stop after working on it for so long.
Yes, they say that, you know, you never finish a film, you simply abandon it at some point, and that's an element of truth. I toured last summer several dates of Where the Rivers Flow North, which I made 35 years ago, and I watched each of those screenings because I was curious about how audiences would be responding now, and I got good crowds in Ferrisburg and a couple of other places, and I enjoyed it. You know, I mean... And as a filmmaker, I think you know, you get to know your film, and they're like children, and you send them off into the world hoping that they will know how to behave themselves and when to, you know, use a handkerchief with a runny nose. But I don't know. I want to get to know this film and really understand where it fits in terms of my own efforts, because you spend years immersed in it, and this is a chance to step away. And I will watch it a lot this summer, I know.
Yeah. Jay, you've been working in film since the late 1960s, and the craft, the tools of the trade have changed so much in the ensuing decades. I'm curious if there is perhaps a tool or a way that film was made back then when you first started out that you miss or that you've considered returning to, even in this more modern era.
Well, the switch from celluloid to digital was a big shift for me, and I resisted it for as long as I could. We shot Disappearances in 2006 on 35mm film when a lot of people were starting to shoot digital at that time. I also found that because people were making the move to digital, the cameras were not being well maintained in the way they had been before, and that editing equipment was also sort of funky. And so, I mean, in fact, we made a move to digital editing before we made a move to digital shooting. So I miss the element of film, which could render, you know, better in some ways, you know, different kinds of textures and color and light than digital can. Although this new generation of digital cameras are good. The company Aeroflex that made the best film cameras is now also making the best digital cameras. And so I accept it at this point. But I miss the sort of sculptural element to editing on film. And I do miss the sort of rendition of that celluloid provided for scenes that you would shoot. And I go back, I was lucky to be able to shoot, you know, 5 feature films, 6 feature films on film. And I value that. At this point, going back to it, it would be so expensive that it's also true, even in those days, it would cost you $400,000 or $500,000 to shoot film as opposed to costs now for digital. And so that makes a difference. Hmm.
Well, Jay, as you move into this next stage of your own career, what plans do you have in place to continue the production of independent film in Vermont, in New England?
Well, it's hard to say. I continue to be involved as the artistic director at Middlebury New Filmmakers Festival. I curate a series at the Billings Farm and Museum, and of course involved with the performing arts presentation in the Northeast Kingdom. And those are all things that I love and really enjoy. I will play a producing role as this semester cinema project continues forward. I want to be as supportive as I can. And it's hard to say where all of that will lead. At the same time, I've recently been in some conversations about developing something around St. Johnsbury that could involve journalism and or documentary filmmaking and somehow to, again, sort of connect community through media or community and culture. And I've always believed that the arts and film provide opportunities for people to come together in shared space and to both explore ideas that are outside their own experience, but also develop perspectives based on their own experience. And so I think that if anything, it'll be something more modest, you know, financially, for one, because the burden of money in each of these projects has been, you know, huge. And that's one reason to sort of step away from it. But I am looking for making local connections, new connections, that also, at a time when local media is threatened, tries to restore some of those connections and see who might come forward.
Hmm. Briefly, you brought up the money aspect of it. If somebody dropped $5 million in your lap today and said, you get to make one more film about a historical figure from our region, who would you pick?
From our region? Mm-hmm. Well, I would probably have to think about that a little bit. I mean, I have a couple of stories. I've worked, it's interesting, when I made Where the Rivers Flow North, which was my first feature film, in some ways, Noel Lord was my Ethan Allen of that moment, but imbued with multiple dimensions because of Howard Mosher's fabulous, fertile imagination. And so this was unusual for me to actually take actual historical characters and try to develop them into historical fiction. You know, characters from this era, I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know.
I put you on the spot there. You could say me. It's fine.
Huh? I could say, yeah. I'll make a movie about you.
Perfect.
We can go into it.
All right, we'll get it in the works. Right. We do have to wrap up now. That's Jay Craven. His latest movie, Lost Nation, will be touring the state this year. He is one of the founders of Kingdom County Productions. Kingdom County's performing arts series, KCP Presents, is a Vermont Public underwriter.
Thaddeus Stevens. There you go.
There you go. All right. I'll be next then. All right. Well, the Vermont Edition team is going to be off tomorrow for the July 4th holiday. We will be back next week with a special week-long series of shows honoring the one-year anniversary of last summer's floods. And we want to hear from you. How do you look back on the floods 1 year later? You can write down your thoughts or record them as a voice memo and email them to us. Our email is vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We always love to hear from you, but we particularly hope to hear from you ahead of Monday as we mark this anniversary. Our show today was directed by Jen Jarecki and produced by Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Our call screener is Rick Barrett, and our theme music was composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.